Do is I'd like to talk with you about Noah's flood, the reality of Noah's flood, how you can know it happened, how you can know it happened about 4,500 years ago, exactly as the Bible says. And so with that in mind then, I'd like you to think about this just as a time of sharing, and I want to ask you a question. I'd like you to tell me, what is the very first thing that you remember happening physically at the beginning of the flood of Noah? Now, I'm not talking about God speaking to Noah or building the ark or loading the ark or closing the door, and this doesn't have to do with Noah, the ark, animals. What was the first thing that happened physically at the beginning of the flood? You can talk to me. I'm from out of town. It's okay. Okay, I think I have 6 to 8 timid voices that said it rained first. We have approximately 250 people in here. I'm sure there's more voices than that. Anybody have another opinion besides rain? Everybody here thinks it rained first. Is that right? No other opinion. No, I told you, it doesn't have to do with arcs. Well, obviously we have a problem here. One of the things I love about Christianity is it comes from the owner's manual. And when you obviously have the wrong answer, you need to go to the owner's manual and get the right answer. So would you all turn in your Bibles and please turn to the convenience store verse of the Bible with me. The convenience store verse of the Bible. That's Genesis 7:11. Oh, I hear you groaning. Listen, no teacher has taught until a student has learned. You ever going to forget the convenience store verse of the Bible? I don't think so. Let's take a look at Genesis 7:11. It says there that in the 600th year of Noah's life, on the 17th day of the second month, correct? Now, stopping right there for a moment, I'd like to make just a couple of points there. First of all, it says that Noah was 600 years old. Now, what does that tell us about Noah? Excuse me, sir? What was that? Did you say he was old? Oh, no, you're going to have to rethink that. Noah was not old. You have to remember that Noah lived to be over 900 years old. He lived more than 300 years after the flood, so at 600 he was just at the end of middle age. Now, you're not thinking much about that right now, but I'm taking a lot of solace in it personally, okay? Another thing, too, did you happen to notice that Noah was 480 years old before God called him into the ministry? So if you think it's ever too late in your life to get into the ministry, hello? Oh, it's not, is it? Another thing, too, it says the flood began on the 17th day of the second month. So what time of the year was that? When did the flood of Noah begin? What's that? Well, I have a vote for spring. Okay, that's kind of a general thing, but anybody more specific? What's that? Oh, one gentleman down here says February. That's very obvious. It says the 17th day of the second month, right?
Right. That's not spring.
Well, the thing is, what's more important is, that's not our calendar. Oh. You see, in the book of Genesis, you don't have the Julian or the Gregorian calendar. What you have is the Jewish civil calendar. That's very, very interesting that I should be with you at this very moment in time. Because at this very moment in time, we just celebrated the Jewish New Year on Monday night and Tuesday of this very week. You see, it's the feast or festival called the Rosh Hashanah. In Hebrew, the word Rosh means chief or head of, and Rosh Hashanah means chief or head of the year. And we call that New Year's Day, don't we? Isn't that chief or head of the year? But New Year's Day on the Jewish civil calendar, which is the only calendar that we have in the book of Genesis, begins in the middle of September. This year, it was Monday night and Tuesday during the day of this very week. Interesting that I should be here with you at this very moment in time. So let's think about that. When did the flood of Noah begin? Well, if obviously New Year's Day is now, if you add 1 month, that's about the middle of October. You add 17 days, and it's going to be about the 1st of November, correct? And so we know that the flood of Noah began about the 1st of November as you and I would count time, because this is not our calendar. And then I wonder something. We might even have some students here that are interested in these kinds of things. If I could show you, now I know that many of you know that God is alive, and many of you know that God is real, but if I could show you how to document that God is not only alive, but that God is actively, providentially working throughout human history, would that be of any interest to you? Hello?
Yes.
Yeah, you can talk with me. It's okay, guys, really, you know. Well, let's think about this for just a second. Would you mind turning to Genesis 8:4? Genesis chapter 8, verse 4. It says in Genesis 8:4 that the ark of Noah came to rest on the mountains of Ararat on the 17th day of the 7th month. Is that correct? Now, if you had a King James Version Bible, for instance, it would say things like, the waters prevailed 150 days, and the ark came to rest on the 17th day of the 7th month. Well, that's exactly 5 months later. So if the flood begins in the beginning of November, basically, then 5 months later is going to be about the 1st of April, correct? And so we know that the flood came to a peak 5 months after it began, about the 1st of April in the following spring. And then the Bible goes on to tell us that the floodwaters then went away for another 5 months. And then there was another couple of months for the earth to dry out so that you could walk on the surface. And then they came out of the ark 370 days after the flood began, a little over 1 year. Now, with that in mind then, in Genesis 8:4, we all agree the ark came to rest on the 17th day of the 7th month, correct? Right? Now would you turn your Bibles to Exodus chapter 12, verses 1 and 2. Exodus chapter 12, verses 1 and 2. Now, I'd like to give you a little timeline. The creation of the earth and the universe is about 6,000 years ago. It's about the year 4,000 B.C. The flood of Noah is 1,656 years later, or basically it's about the year 2350 B.C. So creation's about 4,000 B.C. The flood's about 2350 B.C. Moses is living 1,400 to 1,500 B.C., okay? So that means that Moses is living about 900 to 1,000 years after the flood of Noah, and he's living about 2,500 years after creation, agreed? Right? 4,000 B.C., 1,400 to 1,500, right? 2,500 years after creation, and 900 to 1,000 years after the flood. You'll notice in Exodus 12, verses 1 and 2, that God speaks to Aaron and to Moses, and he says, I want you to make this month the first month of a brand new calendar. It's a calendar for the purpose of religious events. Many Christians fail to understand some great biblical truths because they fail to understand that the Jew has two calendars and not one. The civil calendar begins in the middle of September, but the religious calendar begins between the middle of March and the middle of April. And so what happens? 2,500 years after creation, God takes the seventh month of the calendar, and he makes it the first month of a brand new calendar, correct? So let's think about that. You will now agree with me that the seventh month mentioned in Genesis 8:4 is the same month mentioned in Exodus 12. It's the seventh month. It's called the month of Nisan, and it becomes the first month of the religious calendar. Everybody agree? With that in mind, I'd like to remind you of a few things. Now, we only have time to just briefly go through this. I can show you how to get the materials on this a little later, but the fact of the matter is that at the time of Moses, that's what happens. Now, with that in mind then, take a look, if you would. You'll have to read it for yourself, but during the time of the Exodus, you remember those 10 plagues and let my people go and all that stuff? Hello? Okay, thank you. Okay. Just a little affirmation. It really helps, okay? Now, what I want you to think about is, after the 9th plague comes the 10th plague, which is the death of the firstborn. Everybody kind of familiar with that one, right? Now I'd like to point out something to you you may not be aware of, and that is this. When it says in Hebrew the death of the firstborn, it does not mean the firstborn of every male. It means the firstborn of every female. I want you to think about that. Now, here in Oklahoma, and I go back 5 generations in Oklahoma, would you agree with me you only use one bull for many ladies? Hello? It's cow talk, guys. It's right? Oh. And you remember how in the Old Testament men used to have more than one wife, you know, sometimes, you know, especially kings, you know, right? Oh, so when it says the death of the firstborn, the carnage was much greater than you think it was. It doesn't change the significance of the miracle, but it does change the magnitude. And another thing, too, you should never, ever... By the way, the correct response to what I'm about to tell you is everybody in the room says amen as loud as you can. You got that now? So, never, ever get your education from PBS, the Learning Channel, Discovery Channel, National Geographic, and Hollywood.
Amen.
Thank you. Now, I brought him with me. Now, I want you to think about something. You know, a lot of Christians go to Hollywood-made movies and they think they learn something about Judaism. You know, they go to movies like Fiddler on the Roof, you know? Cat Ballou? Anybody ever heard of Ben-Hur? Okay, yeah, all right. Well, you know, you go to a movie like Fiddler on the Roof, and it has a great little song in it called Sunrise, Sunset, and it's a pretty song. But you know what? A lot of Christians think for that reason the Jewish day begins at sunset. But it doesn't. The Jewish day does not begin at sunset. The Jewish day begins at moonrise. Moonrise. Now, that's only a technical difference, I suppose, but nonetheless, it starts in the evening when the moon rises. You read your Bibles very carefully, and I'm only going to be able to give you the summary. Go back to the Exodus. You'll find that they were told on the 10th day of Nisan in the spring of the year to select a lamb. 4 days later, they were told to slay the lamb at exactly 3 p.m. on the 14th. They applied the blood to the doorposts and to the lintel. Some of you remember this story. But I don't know about you, but I think they were in a hurry. How about you? Look, the death angel is going to come by in about 3 hours. I think they're in a hurry. How about you?
Yeah.
Oh, I see. And when they go splat, splat, and splat with the blood here, don't you think there'd be a little time for the blood to fall on the threshold? Don't you? Oh. So if you think about it, there's actually blood here, 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 and here, wasn't there? Oh, and that evening, behind the door, sealed with the blood on all four sides, they eat the lamb, which is a sign of communion. It's the third sacrifice of the Old Testament. You'll find it in Leviticus 1 through 8. It's the communion offering. And that evening, it's the 15th, and the death angel comes throughout the land, and the firstborn of the Egyptians and of the cattle are killed. About midnight, Pharaoh lets them go. They start walking southeast in the morning. Well, in the morning, they come to a little town in Egypt called Succoth. But in Hebrew, it's actually the word Sukkot. And in English, it's actually the word tabernacle. And they pick up the body of Joseph at Tabernacle. And then they walk the rest of that day, which is the 15th. That evening they stop, they make camp. The moon rises and it becomes the 16th. Next day they get up, they walk the day of the 16th. Next evening they make camp, they stop, and next evening the moon rises and it becomes the 17th. It's the night of the 17th day of Nisan that God performed the parting of the Red Sea. It's on the 17th of Nisan that they walked through the waters of the Red Sea. According to the book of 1 Corinthians, we're told that the nation of Israel was baptized by walking through the waters of the Red Sea and were resurrected out of the waters of baptism onto the Sinai Peninsula. What happened to the Egyptians when they tried to follow in behind? What happened? Oh, that's what happened, right? So the waters of the Red Sea were waters of baptism to the believer, but waters of judgment to the unbeliever. Is that correct? And that was on the 17th day of Nisan, correct? But about 900 to 1,000 years earlier, that's exactly the same day of the calendar that the ark came to rest on Mount Ararat, correct? And you know, it's kind of interesting to me. You think of different arcs in the Bible, but there's only two words, but you find three arcs. But that word ark of Noah, it can be also correctly translated as coffin. C-O-F-F-I-N, coffin. Now, would you agree with me, when you think of a coffin, don't you normally think of death inside and life outside? That is the way you do it around here, isn't it? You know, you guys have me worried, really. But I like you to think about something. Notice the opposite logic which God used at the time of the flood, because he took the seeds of life, placed them inside the coffin, and he condemned the world outside to death, didn't he? And why would the ark be called a coffin? Well, when you think of a coffin, don't you think of a large, rectangular, wooden box? And what was the size and shape of the ark? It was a large, rectangular, wooden box. Looked just like a coffin, you see. And when that coffin came to rest on Mount Ararat on the 17th day of Nisan, the seeds of life contained inside the coffin were resurrected into a new world, weren't they? And it's the same date that they walked through the Red Sea. They were baptized and resurrected too. And if you go to Joshua chapters 3 and 5, you'll find out it was the 10th day of Nisan that they walked through the Jordan River. The new nation born in the desert had to be baptized before it could go into the promised land. And so as a nation, they were baptized by walking through the Jordan. Remember how God parted it the same way he did the Red Sea? And then if you read Joshua chapter 5 verses 10 through 12, you'll find out this. They camped at Gilgal. They celebrated the Passover for only the third time. The lamb must be slain on the 14th at 3 p.m. It says in the day after they ate the lamb. Well, you eat the lamb on the 15th. The day after you eat the lamb is the 16th. That's the last day God provided manna. And then, on the day after that, which is the 17th, they ate only the first fruits of the promised land. In Leviticus 23, the 17th day of Nisan is called the Feast of First Fruits. It's the third of the seven major feasts of the Old Testament. And then if you go down the road, 1,500 years, start with John chapter 12, verse 1. It says that the last week that Jesus walked into Jerusalem, he came into Jerusalem on a Friday during the daylight. And the Bible's quite specific. It says it was the eighth day of Nisan. He goes up to the Mount of Olives to stay with Lazarus, whom he had raised from the dead. That evening, he eats dinner at the Mount of Olives, and that evening, the moon rises. It's Friday night. Well, first of all, the date changes, and it becomes the ninth. But it's also Shabbat, and on Shabbat, he can't leave the Mount of Olives. So Friday night and Saturday, he must stay on the Mount of Olives. Saturday night, the moon rises. The date changes, and it becomes the tenth. And on what we call Palm Sunday, but the 10th day of Nisan that year, Jesus rode into Jerusalem on a colt in fulfillment of prophecy. The people said, Hosanna, Hosanna. It means, you, save us now. And in fulfillment of the prophet Daniel, he was cut off. You see, we still use that word here in Oklahoma. 2,600 years after Daniel used it, you see, what Daniel said was to remove one animal from a herd. That is to say, to remove one steer from a herd, to remove one lamb from a flock. It means to take one individual out of a larger number. And that day, they cut Jesus Christ off, one out of the entire human population. Don't cowboys use cutting horses? Excuse me? I am in the right state, aren't I? Oh. Well, count off. If you count off, they selected him on the 10th, but on the 14th, what did the people say? They said, he's perfect. Slay that one. You see, the lamb must be picked on the 10th and slain on the 14th. And they nailed him to a cross at noon on the 14th. He died at exactly 3 p.m. on the 14th, exactly the same time the little lamb died on the Temple Mount nearby. Well, that left 3 hours for his body to be placed in a tomb. That evening, the moon rises as it becomes the 15th. The people eat the lamb. Well, next day is the 15th. Next evening becomes the 16th. Next day is the 16th. Next evening, Saturday night, it becomes the 17th. And on Sunday morning, the 17th day of Nisan, the resurrection was discovered by the women. Now, I've just shown you four things that have happened on exactly the same day of the calendar, spread out over 2,500 years of human history, all four of which deal with resurrection. Anybody here see the hand of God? Excuse me? Oh, that's documentable evidence. For those of you that are into that sort of thing, we have a syllabus on the feast downstairs on the table. I go through every major and minor feast, do exactly the same thing. God does exactly the same kind of thing on exactly the same day of the calendar, spread over thousands of years of time. That's a vindication of faith. That's documentable evidence. That's something you can use in witnessing. But I also asked you, what was the first thing that happened at the beginning of the flood? So let's go back and take a look at that convenience store verse of the Bible again, okay? Let's go back to Genesis 7:11. What does it say is the first thing that actually happened? After it tells us the date, what does it say? What's that? You probably have a translation that says something like, the fountains of the great deep burst forth or broke open, is that right? And then it rained for 40 days and 40 nights, is that correct? Is that right? Oh, well, why don't you take a look at that place where it says the fountains of the great deep burst forth or broke open. Now, we've got a lot of materials downstairs. We've got audio tapes of presentations and so forth. I want to show you one and one only. There's one down there called The Waters Cleaved. The Waters Cleaved. Why that title, The Waters Cleaved? Well, that's this material. But the reason for the title is because that's what it actually says in Hebrew. It actually says, the waters cleaved. Now, we still use the word to cleave in a variety of ways today, but the word to cleave means to come to a knife edge. To cleave means to come to a knife edge. Isn't there a big meat knife we call a meat cleaver? Hello? Yeah. And you call it a cleaver because it cleaves. It comes to a knife edge, you see? So I am much more concerned in a translation by concept than I'm a translation by word, because there's no such thing as a perfect translation. And even if there were a perfect word-for-word translation, the concepts wouldn't necessarily get across right. So I'm more concerned in a translation by concept. And the concept of what it says in Genesis 7:11 is this: the waters knifed through from below. That's the concept. And so I'd like to do a little scientific experiment here with you this evening. Y'all ready to do a scientific experiment? Good. I'm glad to hear that, because I'm a licensed scientist. I'm licensed to do experiments. And the other thing is, you don't have to worry about safety because I'm wearing goggles. Okay? Now, what I'd like you to do in our little experiment is, I would like you to put everything you're holding in your hand, you know, pencils, books, other people's hands, whatever you're holding on to, and I would just like you to lay those down for a moment. I'd like you to take both your hands, put them in front of you like this, make a nice flat surface, okay? Would everybody just make a nice flat surface, all right? All right. Now, what we're going to do in our little experiment is, your hands are going to represent the top surface of a piece of cheese, okay? And what we're going to do is, we're going to take a knife and we are going to cleave through the cheese. But instead of cleaving downwards as we would normally do, this evening I want you to think of yourselves as big cut-ups. You got to catch them fast. They go by really, you know. Now, here's the top surface of the piece of cheese, okay? What I want you to think of is, if a knife blade came from below, through the cheese, upwards, outwards, penetrated the surface of the cheese, and it went on out, upwards and like this, show me with your hands, what would the top surface of the cheese look like after the knife blade came from below? Just with your hands, show me what would the surface of the cheese look like after the knife came from below. Come on, let's get some of you guys participating here. Okay. All right. Well, look, a few of you went like this, and that's not the way it works. I'm sorry, sir. Okay. Most of you did something like this, okay? Right? That's kind of like, sort of. There was one fellow in the back that simply went, and that doesn't work either, you know. Let me ask you a question, though. Wouldn't the cheese actually do this? Wouldn't the knife blade come from below through the cheese, and wouldn't the cheese actually go like that? Isn't that right? Isn't that right? Now, y'all do this. Oh, come on, you young, supple things. You can't do this. What is wrong with you? I don't understand your problem at all. Back when I was your age and I had to hitchhike to get a ride when I was in college, I used to go like that. Well, I admit, you got to want to go that way, you know. You want to go like that, you got to go like this, you know. Do we all agree the cheese would look like this right here? Hello? We do, don't we? Oh, I see. Well, I've just driven up here 3 days from Orlando to be with you tonight. I brought a little friend with me from Orlando, and I want to show you my little friend. Relax. I know scientists carry live things occasionally, but this is not alive, okay? Now, my little friend happens to be a three-dimensional globe. Now, the thing about having a three-dimensional globe like this and showing you a three-dimensional globe is, number one, I don't know what happened to those lights being turned off, but can we get those back on again right over there? Just those right chandeliers. Number two, I have to have somebody come up here as a volunteer to help me with the globe, you see? And No. Don't go play now. That's better. Thank you. Now, I can even see them over there now. That's amazing. That's good. Let's see now. I need a volunteer to come up here and help me. I've noticed that not one person has raised their hands. And that, I'm sorry, sir, you're the wrong gender. This young lady wants to. Oh, I see. That's great. Come on up here. Would you stand on this side of me, though? And I assume that Stephanie is the correct name. You don't have somebody else's name tag.
No.
Okay. Well, Stephanie, I'm Grady, okay?
Okay.
Now, Stephanie, this is a three-dimensional globe. Isn't that neat?
Wonderful.
Come on, Stephanie. That's really neat.
Great.
It'll do.
Okay.
I'm sure you've seen your typical public school globes before, right? I mean,
uh-huh.
You know, you've seen them, and they have the continents, and sometimes they have lines for the boundaries of states and countries and stuff like that, right?
Right.
But this globe is not like this. This actually has mountains and valleys. Isn't that neat?
Neat.
Sell it, gal. Come on. Well, another thing, too, when you've seen your typical public school globe, would you agree with me that when you see blue, it's normally just ocean surface, right? And you normally just see the island sticking through from below. Is that right? Right?
Right.
And you've seen flat wall maps of the world that are like that, too, right? Mm-hmm. Now, Stephanie, have you ever asked yourself a question, how come evolutionists don't want me to see what's on the bottom of the ocean?
No.
You've never asked that question.
Not really.
That's fine. That's fine. That's not a problem. However, do you think that next time you might?
Might
do that. As a matter of fact, I guarantee it, actually. But I do want you to know the answer before you leave here tonight. You see, evolutionists don't want you to see what's on the bottom of the ocean, because if you could see what was on the bottom of the ocean, you'd start to ask questions they don't want to have to answer. Oh. Yeah, very good. She's good. I liked it. Now, what we did was, see, we took a big old syringe and we sucked all the water off this thing, you see? And everything you see here in blue is what is actually on the bottom of the ocean. Isn't that neat?
Neat.
That's really neat now.
Really?
It's really neat. Okay. There you go. And you know, we can learn a lot from a three-dimensional globe if we're just allowed to see one.
Mm-hmm.
Now, for example, I live down in Florida, right? And how many of you have ever, I mean, you're up here, you wouldn't know anything about this, but how many of you have ever heard about something called the continental shelf? You heard about, oh, bless your hearts, right? That's where the land comes down to sea level, but the land continues out under the water, but it's real shallow till you actually get to the edge of the continent, right? And it goes 2 miles straight down, right? And that's why they call it the continental shelf, right? Okay. Now, down here in Florida, where I live, you'll notice you can, for instance, go to the west side of Florida. You can go to Tampa, Clearwater, Naples, Florida, and so on. You can go 100 miles west into the Gulf of Mexico, and you're still in shallow water. You can still be in 60 to 200 feet of water. But when you get out about 100 miles, okay, it suddenly goes straight down, right? Now, we can actually see that, too. Now, see, there's Florida right there, right? There's that big, wide continental shelf around Florida, right? You see how you get up there about 100 miles, and all of a sudden it just goes straight down, right?
Right.
And you see how they printed this with that flat sand bottom in the middle of the Gulf of Mexico?
Uh-huh.
You know why they did that?
Why?
Because the Gulf of Mexico has a flat sand bottom 2 miles down right there.
Oh.
You really must pay more attention there. It's just... Now, another thing, too. I'm fairly sure you've heard about something called the Mississippi River. Is that true?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Now, the Mississippi River, one of the nicknames for the Mississippi River is called the Big Muddy, right?
Right.
Right? Because every year it carries millions of tons of mud down into the Gulf of Mexico, right?
Right.
Right? Now, when that water gets there, it slows down, and it dumps that mud right at the mouth of the Mississippi, right? It precipitates right there, and it forms a big old half cone of mud right up against the side of the continent there, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And we can actually see that. For example, here's the Mississippi River coming down through St. Louis and New Orleans and so forth into the Gulf of Mexico, and right here, you see that half cone of mud? It's called the alluvial flood cone of the Mississippi River. And it's right there, right?
Right.
It looks like kind of like bridal veil or something, but a big old half cone of mud, right?
Right.
Now, Stephanie, would it be of any interest for you to know there's only 4,500 years worth of mud at the mouth of the Mississippi?
Oh, wow.
Well, apparently would.
Yeah.
I say, I got an oh, wow out of that one, you know. So, well, I'm on oh, wow, too. Now, let's just think about that for a second. There's only 4,500 years worth of mud at the mouth of the Mississippi. And anybody can calculate it, because it's only the delta of the Mississippi 250 miles long, it's forming at a 16th of a mile per year, and that would be 4,000 years just doing simple math, right?
Right.
Okay. So, let's think about this. Do you know how to tell when an evolutionist is lying to you?
How?
Their lips are moving. You always know when an evolutionist is lying to you because their lips are moving. Now, for example, evolutionists say that the Mississippi River has been eroding the North American continent here for millions of supposed years. Now, if that were true, then today the Gulf of Mexico would be filled in, which it most assuredly is not. Is that correct?
That's true.
I see. So I guess their lips were moving, huh?
Must have been.
Hmm. Another thing, too. How many of you are familiar with these words? How many of you know the words plate tectonics? Ah, see, I knew you were an educated crowd. Okay. And also, of course, that goes along with continental drift, right? Ah, okay. Plate tectonics and continental drift are very much alike and so forth, and the concept is that at one time all the continents used to fit together in a big supercontinent they called Pangaea, and they said this big supercontinent existed 120 million supposed years ago, and then they say that that big supercontinent broke apart into pieces 120 million supposed years ago, and then the continents have been drifting apart slowly and gradually. As a matter of fact, here in the Atlantic, they say at the rate of an inch and a half per year for 120 million supposed years in order to get the thousands of miles that we see here today, right?
Right.
Now, first of all, let me ask you a question. if you wanted to know how well the continents really fit together, okay? Now, do we all agree when you take a look at a standard globe or a standard wall map of the world, it does sort of kind of look like the continents fit together, right? Right? Hello? Kinda? Kinda, right? But if you really wanted to know how well they do fit together, would you want to take a look at sea level today, or would you want to take a look at the edge of the continent? Well, when you put a jigsaw puzzle together, where do the pieces fit? On the edge. Oh, I see. So you wouldn't want to look at sea level. You'd want to take a look at the edge, right?
Right.
I want to take you down to Argentina.
Okay.
Here's Argentina. You know Argentina at sea level has a very ragged coastline, doesn't it?
Yep.
Right? But you also notice it has a big, wide continental shelf off of Argentina right there, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
I see. As a matter of fact, it's bigger and wider than off of Florida, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
And it has a nice smooth V shape, doesn't it? Now, here in Brazil, do you notice this indentation, bulge, indentation, and bulge in Brazil?
Mm-hmm.
Over here in Africa, do you notice that indentation, bulge, indentation, and bulge in Africa?
Mm-hmm.
Nice smooth V shape there at the bottom?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Now, if you were to move those 4 points to here, move that nice smooth V over to there, how good a fit would that be? Does the word perfect come close?
A little bit.
Right, close to perfect, right?
Pretty close.
Okay, I see. So we really can't see those two continents really did fit over there one time,
right, can
we? Right. And if you take a look at the continental shelf of Antarctica right there, you'll find it fits into Australia right there.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that neat?
Neat.
Oh, so we really can see that those three continents used to fit with the others, can't we?
Mm-hmm.
It may surprise you to know that creationists like myself and evolutionists really do believe that all continents fit together, you know, at one time. We agree they broke apart, and we agree that they moved to where they are today. What we disagree on is the amount of time. Because they say it takes 120 million supposed years, and I say it takes one.
Mm-hmm.
Now, would you agree with me, Stephanie? We both couldn't be right at the same time, right?
Right.
Right. I mean, one of us is 119,999,999 years off exactly, correct?
True.
Right?
Right.
Okay. So, with that in mind then, let's see if we can kind of figure this out, right?
Okay.
Now, again, would you like to travel some more?
Sure.
Okay, how about a cruise?
Okay.
Great food.
Yeah.
Okay. Let's go over here to the Indian Ocean, okay?
Okay?
Now, here's the Indian Ocean. We're going to take a little cruise on the Indian Ocean.
Okay.
Now, only 6 months ago, I was standing right there looking at the Indian Ocean for the second time, and I found this very interesting. It looks exactly like the Gulf of Mexico, and they're both wet. It's one of those things, you know, if you've seen one ocean,
you've seen them all.
You got it. Now, let's take a little look here at the bottom of the Indian Ocean. Do you notice these tall, pointy, cone-shaped things right there?
Uh-huh.
Those are underwater volcanoes, which is why they have that tall, pointy cone shape. They're actually underwater volcanoes.
Okay.
And here's a ridge on the bottom of the Indian Ocean called the 90 East Ridge. That's mildly interesting, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then here you'll notice this feature in the bottom of the Indian Ocean right there, correct?
Right.
Now that's called an underwater mountain range, okay?
Okay.
Now for the sake of those that are way in the back over there without binoculars, I was wondering if you could describe for them how this actually looks. Does it look like it has peaks down the middle, like the Andes, or does it look like there's a big black gap in the middle, two parallel ridges on either side, and the land goes like that?
It's more like it goes like that.
I see. Okay, so we see a big black gap, two parallel ridges, and the land goes like
that.
Yeah, okay. Yes, because you see, Stephanie, that's the fountains of the great deep. That's where the waters knife through from below at the time of the flood of Noah. Oh. And we can see how that crack perfectly fits how Antarctica was broken off of Australia here, can't we?
Yep.
Right? And then it goes on across the Pacific Ocean right here, making that big smiley face right there, doesn't it?
Yes,
right?
It does.
It does, right there. And then it comes in here at the Baja, and it becomes the San Andreas Fault here in California. Isn't that interesting? Y'all have heard about the San Andreas Fault, right?
Yes.
Now, something that you wouldn't know about me, I was actually born in Children's Hospital, San Francisco, California, right on top of the San Andreas Fault. Never suffered any permanent damage from it, but that's where I was born. Stop that. That crack continues right on up here around the Pacific, around the Alaska, the Aleutians, down here past Japan, the Philippines, and out here across New Guinea here to Samoa.
Mm-hmm.
Turns 90 degrees at Samoa, goes right straight through New Zealand and meets itself again right there. Isn't that neat?
Neat.
Come on, that's really neat.
That's really neat.
Okay, there you go. Now, Stephanie, I am sure that with your keen powers of scientific observation, you had also noticed that that crack splits here in the Indian Ocean, here and goes south of Africa, right up the middle of the Atlantic, perfectly fitting the shape of the continents until it comes right up here and ends very close to, but not at, the North Pole. Is that right?
That's right.
Which also goes to show that Santa Claus built on bad ground right there, too.
Yes.
Well, nonetheless, now, Stephanie, I've just shown you where the crack goes all the way around the world, breaks off three continents, ends, right?
Right.
What would you then want to know? I've just shown you where the crack ends.
Where does it begin?
Where does it begin? Excellent question. I'm so glad you asked that question. Let's go back to the Indian Ocean. You notice that that crack splits here in the Indian Ocean, goes east, west, breaks off three continents, correct? But if you follow it north here, it's just one crack.
Yeah.
If you follow it up here towards Saudi Arabia, you notice it comes here around the Horn of Africa, and you can also see it's starting to get smaller and smaller, can't you?
Yeah.
Right? You also notice it turns here at the south end of the Red Sea, turns, goes right straight up the bottom of the Red Sea, all the way to the north end, getting smaller and smaller, correct?
Correct.
Right. Now, I'm sure with your keen powers of eyesight, you also notice it turns right here at a port city in Israel called Eilat, and it turns and goes right straight up here and starts at that point right there, correct?
Correct.
Correct. Okay. So that means it turns and goes right straight through the bottom of the Dead Sea, right straight up the bottom of the Jordan River, right straight through the bottom of the Sea of Galilee, right straight up through the bottom of the River Jordan, and starts where the River Jordan starts at a place the Bible here calls Caesarea Philippi. Now, I'm sure you all have heard about Caesarea Philippi, haven't you? Well, some of you have. You know, this is where Jesus took his disciples a two-day walk north out of Capernaum up into the Golan Heights to ask them two questions. He said to them first, "Who do men say that I am?" And then he said, "Now, who do you say that I am?" Now, that second one is one of the two most important questions in the entire New Testament. How you answer that question determines your eternal destiny. And he asked that question, "Who do you say that I am?" And then, well, that was right at the point where the crack starts and goes all the way around the world and breaks off three continents. Now, do you think that was just by accident?
Probably not.
Probably not. Probably not. Well, yeah, I agree with you, probably not. But, you know, I'm a scientist, you know, so we got to test these things out and apply mathematics and stuff like that. One of the things I love about coming to Texas out of Florida is you guys are so much smarter up in Oklahoma than the Texas. I just came out of Texas, folks. And Oklahoma, but y'all are so much smarter over this way, you know?
I agree.
I knew you would. Because you see, down in Florida, we have a tax on stupidity. It's called the Florida Lottery. And it's a tax on stupidity because the chances of winning the Florida Lottery are one chance in 15 million chances per week, right? Mm-hmm. And I wanted to calculate the odds of Jesus going to the one spot on the earth where the crack starts and breaks off three continents just by chance, you see? So we applied the math to that, and we figured it was the same as you winning the Florida lottery every single week for the entire rest of your life.
Oh.
Without ever buying a ticket.
Oh.
It's kind of like no chance at all, isn't it?
Really?
Yeah, really, yeah. Another thing, too. Do y'all remember reading in Genesis chapter 1 when God created the earth, he created the earth with the waters above and the waters below?
Yeah.
Y'all have read the first page, haven't you?
Yeah.
Okay. So, let's think about this. When God created the earth, he created the earth, well, the shell here was whole and complete, like an egg with no crack, okay? And there was a lot of moisture in the upper atmosphere, waters above, and so on. And here in the Pacific, and here in the Indian, there was a sea 1 mile deep. But here in the Atlantic, there really was no Atlantic because the land masses fit together, correct?
Correct.
But let me ask you a question, Stephanie. That terminology, waters below. Now, couldn't that also include waters that are inside? Wouldn't that be below?
Yes.
It would be, right?
Right.
Now, I want you to watch this, and I want you to help me count, okay?
Okay.
Folks, how many of you remember being taught in school that 92 years ago, we scientifically proved that there was a layer of water about a half a mile to a mile deep, located roughly 4 to 8 miles underneath the Earth's surface from the time of creation to the time of the flood of Noah? I didn't see any hands, did you?
I don't see any.
No, not one. Isn't that interesting? Isn't that interesting? A Christian Serbian scientist whose name was Moho Ravisic in 1909 proved there used to be a layer of water about 0.6 to 1.0 miles deep located 4 to 8 miles underneath the Earth's surface from the time of creation to the time of the flood of Noah. We've known about that for 92 years. Don't you think it's about time we started teaching it in school? Excuse me?
Yes.
Right? Oh. Another thing, too. Now, Stephanie, I want you to think about this. When God created the Earth, he created the Earth whole and complete, no cracks here. And that layer of water down underneath there, right? Now, when you go in the Earth gets hotter at the rate of 118 degrees Fahrenheit per mile on average as you go in. And so if you go down 4 miles, the temperature is about 480 degrees Fahrenheit, right?
Right.
Now, what do you call liquid water at 480 degrees Fahrenheit?
Steam?
Well, it wouldn't be steam because it'd be steam on the surface at 212, I agree. But this is liquid water at 480. Well, okay, look. Do you remember, just a few years ago, you were in Grandma's kitchen. She had something called a pressure cooker. You ever seen one of those? Antique store, maybe.
Okay.
Okay. Well, you know, if you put enough pressure on water, you can keep it liquid above 212, because that's the way we used to cook fast before microwaves, you know?
Oh,
right?
Okay.
See? Now, here we have 4 to 8 miles of solid rock, and so that's enough to keep it liquid at 480 degrees, you see?
Okay.
Okay. But actually, the technical term for liquid water at 480 degrees Fahrenheit, it's called super hot water. That really is the technical term, folks. Well, so, if you think about it, it's really just liquid steam. It's really just an accident looking for a place to happen, you see? Okay? Steam is tremendously powerful. As a matter of fact, it's basically the second most powerful force in nature. And so I want you to think about this. God put that layer of liquid steam, that accident looking for a place to happen underneath the earth's shell there, and then below that the rest of the earth, at the time of creation, knowing he was going to need it 1,656 years later. So I think you must be a pretty good planner, don't you?
I think so.
I mean, I can only plan out about 20, 40 years personally. You know, maybe you're better at it than I am. I don't. Tomorrow's a problem?
Could be.
Could be. Okay. Now, so let's think about this. Now, what happened at the time of the flood? Okay. God says 1,656 years after creation, it's time for the flood, you see? So he gets out this 4-mile-long pin.
Okay.
Brings it over here to what is today Caesarea Philippi. Sticks it down through the earth's crust, 4 miles down, that layer of liquid steam, that accident looking for a place to heaven.
Right?
And then he goes, right? Now, what do you think is going to happen next?
Water
shoots out.
Yeah.
Ladies and gentlemen, this young lady is into the gift of understatement. Okay, so this liquid water, this liquid steam, is going to come to the surface. When it hits the surface, it's going to hit atmospheric pressure, which means it's going to explode in a huge steam explosion, you see? So actually, the water is going to come up and it's going, boom! Is that right?
I think that's right.
That's about right. Oh, I see. Now, what's that going to do to the size of the hole?
It'll probably increase it
up. Yeah, it can make the hole bigger.
Right.
I see. Well, what's that going to do to the amount of water coming up?
More water.
Sure, you're going to get more water, but that's going to blow, and so it's going to make a bigger... And then you're going to get more
water.
Then a bigger
hole.
More
water.
Bigger
hole.
More water. Bigger hole. More water. Get in the rhythm of this thing. Well, yeah, that's good. All right. Now, so you'll notice here that that crack starts forming and heading south, getting slightly bigger and slightly bigger.
Yes.
Turns here, comes down this way, getting slightly bigger and slightly bigger until it gets right there.
Right.
And when it gets right there, it no longer has to cut all the way through the continent. It only has to cut through the ocean floor. Is that correct? So it has less work to do, so it can do more work faster, you see?
Right.
And so we see it actually comes out here, gets bigger faster, comes down here, splits, goes east, west, breaks off three continents. Isn't that neat? I mean, really neat.
Yes.
It's very neat.
Very neat.
Super neat.
Super neat.
Super neat. All right. Now, oh, come on, work with us here, folks. Yes. So let's think about this. Now, let's go back to the Atlantic for a second, and let's think about something, okay?
Okay.
Now, if evolutionists were telling us the truth about what had happened in the past, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And the continents all fit together, we agreed, broke apart, moved to where they are. We agreed, okay? But if they were right, that this is only an inch and a half per year for 120 million supposed years, okay? Mm-hmm. Well, let's think about that. That means every year, then, the rainwater ought to wash mud in off the edge of the continent into the bottom of the ocean. Is that correct? Right? And if the continents are only separating an inch and a half per year, should I not have a thick layer of mud going from one continent to the other across the bottom of the Atlantic?
Probably.
I should, right?
Right.
If they're telling the truth, right?
Exactly.
I see. Now, if I could show you one piece of evidence that they're wrong and I'm right, that would be good, right?
Correct.
If I could show you four pieces that I was right and they're wrong, that would be better.
Much
right?
Better.
Okay. Did you happen to notice that here off of Florida, the Carolinas, New York, Newfoundland, there's a flat sand bottom off the North American continent. Is that correct?
Correct.
I see. No mud, huh?
Don't see any.
Bummer. Down here at the mouth of the Amazon, do you notice there's only 4,500 years worth of mud at the mouth of the Amazon? Flat sand bottom on either side up next to the continent. Is that correct?
That's correct.
I see. Here we have a flat sand bottom off of Argentina.
Yes.
Off of Africa.
Yes.
Off of Europe.
Yes.
So there is no thick layer of mud going from one continent to the other. Is that correct?
That's correct.
I see. So that's one good reason to know they're wrong and I'm right, correct?
But
let's take a look at some others. Now, number two, of course, you'll notice that we have this crack that goes up the middle.
Yes.
And we see number three, the land goes like that, correct?
Correct.
Right?
Right.
Now, concerning number four, I do want to make one disclaimer. I am not suggesting that you have personally experienced this particular phenomenon, okay?
Okay.
However, have you been around other women that have had babies?
Yes.
That's all you need to know. Okay. Now, looking closely here, did you happen to notice these marks going east and west across the crack here?
Mm-hmm.
I see. Do these marks remind you of anything you've ever seen before?
Just stretch marks.
Oh. I love the way she said that. Just stretch marks. Yes. Yes, as a matter of fact, those are stretch marks.
Oh.
Now, you only get stretch marks when things happen fast, like 9 months. Is that right?
Yes. Yes.
Oh. Yeah. Well, the Earth is bigger, see, so it took 12. Y'all have to think about this, don't you? I can tell. Well, now, that's good, actually. So, I have a flat sand bottom, crack goes up the middle, land goes like that, and stretch marks, correct?
Correct.
I don't need anything more to tell me this all happened fast, like 1 year, do I?
No.
That's right, isn't it?
Yep.
Oh. Another thing, too, I'm sure with your keen powers of scientific observation, you had noticed that here in the Atlantic we have wide continental shelves on both sides, and there's no significant mountain ranges along the edge. Here in the Pacific, however, we have razor-thin continental shelves, is that correct?
Correct.
And the mountains are right along the edge, right? The Andes of South America, the Sierras of Mexico and California, the mountains of Alaska, the Aleutians, Kamchatka, Japan, the mountains of the Philippines. Here in New Guinea, the mountains are on the Pacific side of the island, correct?
Yes.
And here in Australia, the only significant mountain range goes right along the edge of the Pacific, correct?
Correct.
I see. Now, Stephanie, do you think that with our two minds working together, we can figure out the difference in why the Atlantic and the Pacific are so different?
I think so.
Good. I'm glad you have confidence in us. I want you to think about something with me for just a moment. I want to ask you a very simple question, and I want a very simple answer.
Okay. Okay?
If I had a boat floating on water, okay, and I punched a hole in the bottom of the boat,
yes,
what would happen?
I think it would sink.
Because?
Water would fill it.
Okay, so water goes up and boat goes
down.
See, I told you it was simple.
Yeah.
Now, do you remember in the Pacific, God started with a sea 1 mile deep, but there was a layer of water 1 mile deep down underneath the crust, right?
Right.
Remember that big old smiley face right here?
Mm-hmm.
Oh. Well, at the beginning of the flood, the water comes up through that crack, right?
Mm-hmm.
So if the water goes up, the boat must go down. I want you to get a whole new idea of what happened in the Pacific Ocean at the time of the flood of Noah, because the entire flood there caused the entire bottom of the ocean here to sink down like an elevator 1 mile. First of all, you'll notice that here from India to Australia, along the south slope of Sumatra, there are two continental shelves, correct?
Correct.
One is a mile deep, then it breaks off, goes another mile deep, correct?
Correct.
Oh. Here in the Pacific, from Alaska to Kamchatka, along the south slope of the Aleutian Islands, there are two continental shelves, correct?
Correct.
One is a mile deep, then it breaks off, goes another mile deep. We can see it, correct?
Right.
And here past Japan, China, and Vietnam, we can clearly see two continental shelves, right?
Right.
Showing how the ocean floor broke off and sank 1 mile as a mile of water came up, correct?
Correct.
That's pretty good, right?
That's pretty good.
But we agreed that two pieces of evidence is better than one.
Right.
Right? Now, this is the equator of the Earth. North of the equator, on the floor of the Pacific Ocean, there are 20,000 volcanoes. 20,000 volcanoes just on the floor of the North Pacific. Now, you know that the Hawaiian Islands are just volcanoes that stick out of the water, right?
Okay.
And we can actually see them here. See, those are the tall mountains of the Hawaiian Islands sticking out of the water right there, right? And we see thousands of volcanoes underwater here, don't we?
Right.
But I was wondering if I could ask you to do something. Would you look very carefully right there? You see in the middle of those pointy ones? You see that flat-topped one right there?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, now that you know what to look for, you see a slightly smaller one right there,
mm-hmm,
right? And there are some over here.
Mm-hmm.
And we see a string from Hawaii to the Aleutians right there called the Emperor Seamounts, correct?
Uh-huh.
The Emperor Seamounts. Now, these flat-topped underwater seamounts that I've just shown you are not volcanic cones, are they? They have flat tops, right? They are called GYOTS, G-U-Y-O-T-S, GYOTS, okay? But the word Giyo means submerged island. Now, these flat-top submerged islands, the top of the flat-top seamount is about 4,000 to 5,000 feet below sea level, typically. Around the flat edge of the mountain on top, we find sandy beaches. And on the side of the mountain below the sandy beaches, we find dead coral reefs. Only this is a kind of coral that only grows within 300 feet of the surface of the ocean. Could you just explain to everybody here what we're doing with coral that only grows within 300 feet of the surface, 5,000 feet below sea level? Well, 5,000 feet's about a mile, right? Uh-huh. So, I see. So these used to be islands before the flood, and
right,
a mile of water came out from below, so now they're a mile down, and the water's a mile on top. Is that right?
Right.
Neat, huh?
Neat.
Super neat?
Super neat.
Fabulous.
Fabulous.
Marvelous.
Marvelous.
Wonderful.
Wonderful.
I'm such a good ventriloquist. I can't stand it. If you would all please give her a big round of applause, she gets to sit down. Thank you. What I've just shown you is so important that downstairs we have three-dimensional globes for sale because of a part of our educational ministry. There's also a big black book down there by Dr. Walter Brown. Let me show you something, because in this book, there's a picture of a 3D globe. And the background literature after it, if you were to take a tape of this message and look at this page or look at a 3D globe, you'd literally reproduce what Steph and I were just doing up here. With that in mind, though, I did bring you some other things to take a look at very quickly as we close, though. We're going to turn off just these lights right here. Hello. Ladies and gentlemen, that is a three-dimensional, accurate map at the bottom of the Gulf of Mexico and part of the Atlantic. Right here, you can clearly see there's only 4,500 years worth of mud at the mouth of the Mississippi. Right here, there's only 4,500 years worth of mud at the mouth of the Amazon. The Gulf of Mexico is a big, empty hole in the ground. If it was as old as evolutionists say it is, it would be filled in completely. And let's just take a little look. Here's the Indian Ocean. Here's that crack that Steph and I were just looking at here. You can follow it here, around the Horn of Africa, right up the bottom of the Red Sea, turns, goes right straight through the bottom of the Dead Sea, up the Jordan, through the Sea of Galilee, up the Jordan, and starts at Caesarea Philippi right there. And you can see how it comes right out here, splits and goes east and west, breaks off three continents. Right here, you can see where there are two continental shelves. You can see here where it broke off. It was 1 mile deep, then it's broken off and gone another mile deep. How about in the Pacific? Here's the Pacific Ocean. Here's that crack coming out of the Indian Ocean, breaking off Antarctica from Australia. If this was not a flat map but a globe, you'd see they fit perfectly. You see how that crack here comes across the entire Pacific Ocean here, comes in at the Baja, becomes a San Andreas Fault here in California, comes around the Pacific here, down along through here, out across here to Samoa, turns 90 degrees and goes right straight through New Zealand and meets itself here. If you look at the continental shelf off of New Zealand here, you'll notice that it perfectly fits the continental shelf of Australia. You can see the crack right there where they broke apart, and you can see the stretch marks right here where they moved rapidly apart. How are we doing so far? Not bad? No. Well, also, of course, with a crack that then comes from here down this way and joins here, we have what's called the Pacific Ring of Fire, the volcanic ring of fire, right along the crack here, here, and on around. All of this is active volcanic area all the way around the crack. Now, how well do those continents fit together? Take a look for yourself. See that nice smooth V shape here off of Argentina? And you'll also notice something else too. You notice how all these points right here line up right along here. But here's that peninsula of land underneath the Falkland Islands right here. You'll notice if you take a look at the back side of that peninsula of land right there, it fits the scars right here. If you don't believe those don't fit together, take a look here in the North Atlantic. Here we have Newfoundland, the Grand Banks here. Do you see this peninsula of land underwater right there? Can y'all see that peninsula of land right there? Kind of looks like a knife blade turned sideways. Is that right? Oh. Well, you'll notice that that perfectly fits into that notch north of Spain right there. And you really can see how all these fit together perfectly. Now, of course, you've got to ask yourself one question. How could three continents move thousands of miles in only 1 year? Well, let me ask you a question. How easy is it to push a boat away from a dock if the boat is floating on water? It's quite easy, is that right? Oh, even a child can push a boat away from a dock if it's floating on water, correct? Oh. Well, let's think about it. When God created the earth, he created the earth's crust whole and complete with no crack. There was a layer of water underneath, as well as water on the surface and in the atmosphere. But when that water knifes through from below, what does it do? It breaks the surface, the crust, up into big boats we call continents. And those continents are able to slip, slide away on that layer of water very, very quickly. So what happens? The water comes up and the continents move apart. The water comes up and the continents move apart, moving on that layer of water just like a boat sliding away from a dock. But eventually, so much water comes up from below that eventually the continents have to sink down as the water comes up from underneath. And eventually the continents not only move, but they finally sink down and they lock into place where they are today. There are still large, large pockets of fresh water underneath the Earth's surface, still trapped in pockets down there, And that water is still coming up every year. As a matter of fact, it's called juvenile water, water that's never been on the Earth's surface before. Active volcanoes bring this water up at the rate of 1 cubic mile on average per year. And so about 4,500 cubic miles of water have been added to the ocean since the time of the flood, and that water coming up from below. And let's take a little look too. How long have we known about this information? Please notice that this cross-sectional drawing comes from the American Journal of Science, 1946. This is 55 years old. Here we have a cross-section through the second largest GEO in the Pacific. Stephanie, do you remember I showed you the second one? And this is called Hess GEO. The largest is Johnson GEO, but this is Hess GEO. You'll notice it's 10 miles across here. It's not a small piece of land. You'll notice that here we have the Pacific Ocean, the surface. Here we have the flat-topped underneath island. You notice the edge of it's about 4,000 feet below sea level. Up here on the top, well, we have sandy beaches on the edge. Down here on the side, we have dead coral reefs, approximately 4,000, 5,000 feet below sea level. The top of the GEOs are typically anywhere from 5 to 8,000 feet above the ocean floor. And we've known about this for 55 years. Now, I would agree with you if you want to make an argument that one GEO does not an argument make. Something could happen at that one location we just don't understand. And I agree with you completely. However, here's a drawing done for another scientific journal in 1959. Here is a map of the Pacific Ocean, and you'll notice the legend here says that black dots are islands, circles are GEOs, or submerged islands known to exist in 1959. That's 42 years ago, correct? And here you see the black dots of the Hawaiian archipelago right here. Here you see the black dots of the islands of the South Pacific. But if you'll notice right here and here, in the center and to the west, from Hawaii to the Aleutians, the string called the Emperor Seamounts right here. Here in the Gulf of Alaska, here off of California and Mexico, we have known GEOs known to exist 42 years ago. Now, if I have GEOs, all of which are approximately a mile underwater, in the south, the north, the east, the west, and in the middle, doesn't that indicate that it all happened all over the same? That the ocean floor sank 1 mile all over? Agreed? Oh. Well, we've known about that for 42 years. Why aren't we teaching it? And then, of course, another question, too. I want you to think about something. I showed you that there were 20,000 volcanoes on just the floor of the northern Pacific alone. That's not the ones that are included in the South Pacific or all the way around the world. Now, let me ask you a question. What would happen to the Earth if 20, 30, 40,000 volcanoes all went off at the same time? What do you think would happen? Well, first of all, volcanic ash would come out as well as volcanic rock and hot water, right? And that ash would go up into the upper atmosphere where all that moisture was. And what would happen? Well, the moisture up there would condense on those ash particles. It would be just like seeding clouds because the ash particles would be the nuclei for raindrops. And so what's it going to do? Well, it's going to rain. For how long? How long? Well, this side knows the answer. How about you guys over there? Oh, 40 days and... 40 nights, yeah, about that long. But then all that moisture comes down in 40 days and 40 nights of rain. That's going to leave a lot more ash up there than is necessary for the rain because thousands and thousands of volcanoes all going off at the same time produce tremendous amounts of ash. And so after the rain comes down, the earth is going to be blanketed with a layer of ash. And what's going to happen? Well, I want you to think about this. Here, this is just a comparative size of historical volcanoes of the past. Notice over here, we do a presentation about the eruption of Mount St. Helens on May the 18th of 1980. In 1980, on May the 18th, Mount St. Helens, a relatively small volcano in the southwest corner of Washington State, erupted with a force equal to a 20-megaton atomic bomb. It was a natural steam explosion inside the mountain from hot water coming up from below, and it erupted with a force equal to 20 million tons of TNT. It then continued to erupt for 9 straight hours, producing the same amount of energy as a Hiroshima-sized atomic bomb every second for 33,000 seconds. In 9 hours, that volcano released 430 megatons of force. That's this one. That's this one right here. It produced 1 cubic kilometer of ash. Compare that volcano I've just described to Vesuvius in 79 AD, buried the cities of Pompeii and Herculaneum. Well, it produced 3 cubic kilometers of ash, or 3 times the size of Mount St. Helens in 1980. But let's compare that to Krakatoa. Krakatoa erupted in 1883. Krakatoa is the largest single naturally produced sound ever heard. Krakatoa is on the island of Sumatra, the northeast corner of the Indian Ocean. The eruption was so violent that it was heard in downtown London, England, some hours later. It was a dirty volcano. It produced 18 cubic kilometers of ash, 18 times the size of Mount St. Helens. Now, I don't know how many of you ever visited the American Southeast, but down in South Georgia, they would call that small pickings. Take a look at Tambora, 1815. Tambora was a relatively dirty volcano. As a matter of fact, one of the most dirty on Earth. It produced 80 cubic kilometers of ash, 80 times the size of Mount St. Helens. Now, you don't have to believe me. Just look this up for yourself in any good encyclopedia. Look up the year 1816. Look up a reference for the year without summer. The year without summer. Because 1 year after that volcano erupted, it so blanketed the earth with a layer of ash in the upper atmosphere that sunlight bounced off the top of the ash layer back into outer space. And what happened? The earth cooled so rapidly that 1 year later there was no summer. It snowed in all 12 months of the year in Europe, the year 1816. Well, let me ask you something. If one volcano can cause the Earth to cool so fast that there's no summer the next year, what would happen if 20, 30, 40,000 volcanoes all went off at the same time? What would you get? Oh, you'd get an ice age, is that right? Oh, yeah. When I was your age, I grew up at Berkeley. On the campus at the University of California, Berkeley. They taught me there were 11 different ice ages in the past. Most public school systems today teach that there were 4 ice ages, but the truth is there was only 1 ice age, and it occurred immediately after the flood of Noah, caused by volcanic activity at the time of the flood of Noah, and frankly, it was no big deal. I want to show you something. It was no big deal. This is a map which accurately shows the maximum extent of the polar ice cap in the northern hemisphere. Now, this is the maximum extent that ice has ever covered the northern hemisphere. In the south, it's basically irrelevant to us. What I want you to see about something is this. I want to make a point. God always provides. God always provides. Think with me for a moment. How did the people and the animals, as well as the plants, survive in the middle of an ice age? Well, first of all, I'd like you to think about something with me for a moment. Do you remember that, here we see the ice. It covered Iceland, Greenland, Canada, small portions of the northern U.S., England, Ireland, Scotland, Scandinavia, and small portions of northern Russia. The ice never got as far south as Berlin, but the people, animals, they came out of the ark here and walked back to here. And how did God keep them warm in the middle of an ice age? It's very simple. Remember the Atlantic Ocean? It didn't used to be there. But now it is there. It's 2 to 3 miles deep, and it's full of nice warm water. Remember that hot water that came up from below? That hot water that came up from below, mixed with the water that was already there to begin with, mixed with the 40 days of rain that came down as well, and now here we have a nice warm ocean. And winds go from basically west to east, and the first time in human history winds of any significance occur after the flood, and the winds come from west to east, coming across this nice warm ocean, bringing warm air then on top of the land here, keeping people, plants, and animals warm in the middle of an ice age. Isn't it interesting how God always provides? It is, isn't it? Oh, I think so too. You see, folks, I'm trying to show you something. Maybe you don't understand all the things I'm showing you, but I do want you to see some things. Another thing, too. I suspect most of you are not really cooking for your own food needs at the moment, though some of you may be. And you might be some really good cooks in here, too. So I wouldn't suggest that any of you in here have ever cooked a souffle that had it fall, but have any of you ever known somebody that cooked a souffle and had it fall? Two hands. Does anybody in this room know what a souffle is? Two hands. Okay. Well, ladies and gentlemen, when a souffle falls, what happens is this. It falls in the middle, and the ends turn up. Now, I pointed out to you something. Let's go to this slide right here. If I told you the truth, let's think about what happened in the Pacific Ocean at the time of the flood. To begin with, there was water stored down below. There are flat-topped islands in the Pacific. But at the beginning of the flood, what happens? The water's knifed through from below. Well, if the waters go up, the boat must go down. And so the earth is a sphere, but if you cut it in the middle, it would be a circle. And if you cut a piece of a circle, that's an arc. And if an arc falls towards the center of a circle, the arc must get shorter and shorter. Agreed? Now, this is 4 to 8 miles of solid rock. Is it going to fold up like an accordion? No. So what can it do? Well, the only thing it can do is like a souffle. It falls in the middle, and the ends turn up. And think about it. If what I've told you is true, at the end of the flood, we should have this. We should have here the ocean floor sinking 1 mile, taking flat-topped islands called geos underneath the water, now a mile of water on top. And we should have the ends turned up. Now, I am actually originally from California. That's where I was born. If you know anything about the mountains of California, you know that they are called tilted, block-faulted mountains. And they look just like this. And you may never have been to Australia, but I bet you know what the mountains of Australia look like. They are tilted, block-faulted mountains that look just like that. Isn't that interesting? Oh. What I'm trying to show you is this. The Bible is not just telling you the truth. The Bible is not merely accurate. The Bible is hyper-accurate. Did you hear me? Every single description of the flood of Noah, both in Genesis chapter 7 and 8, as well as Psalm 104, every detail of the flood is found in the physical evidence on the surface of the earth, and that physical evidence is clearly visible if you're allowed to see it. And the Bible isn't just telling you the truth. It is not merely accurate. The Bible is hyper-accurate. Now, if the Bible is hyper-accurate about simple geologic features on the surface of the earth, do you not agree with me it might then be super-accurate about spiritual truths? Excuse me? Did I suddenly go deaf? Let's try that again. If it's hyper-accurate about simple geologic features on the surface of the earth, wouldn't it then also be hyper-accurate about spiritual truths?
Yes.
Amen. That's the point I'm really trying to make to you tonight. I didn't become a Christian until I was 27 after I earned my degrees in science. I didn't become a creationist until I was 28. It took me 16 months after I became a Christian to take a look at the science I had been taught and realize I'd been lied to my entire life. That there was lots of scientific evidence, lots of interpretations that I had never been allowed to see, never been allowed to think about, that I had not been taught to think critically, but I had been taught to memorize. You want to know how to get an A in every course you have? I'll tell you. You learn everything they teach you, and you give it back exactly the way they want it. You'll get an A every time. Did anybody in this room hear me say it had to be right? Excuse me? No, it does not have to be right. It just has to be what they want, given back the way they want it. The day I became a creationist was the day I asked myself one last question, and that question was this. Could the law of gravity ever evolve? I couldn't think of any way gravity could evolve. And if gravity cannot have evolved, gravity had to come into existence whole and complete. And if gravity came into existence whole and complete, it had to be created. And then I did the same thing with all the other laws I knew of science. The first, second, third law of thermodynamics. The laws of genetics are conservative, not creative. Laws of motion, gas laws, all the other laws I knew. Every single one of those laws would have to come into existence whole and complete and therefore had to be created. Then I took a look at natural process. No process is of any value unless it's whole and complete. You take one step out of photosynthesis, it doesn't work. That means that every process must come into existence whole and complete, which means it has to be created. And finally, I reevaluated the physical evidence. You see, I grew up on the campus at the University of California, Berkeley. I learned about paleontology very early and very well from evolutionary believers. I was learning about evolution, fossils, and so forth, dinosaurs, when I was a child from PhDs. And what I came to realize is this. Those pretty little charts we showed you during that skit at the beginning of our time together, that doesn't exist. That's an illustration in a textbook. There's not one place on the surface of the entire Earth that you'll find those layers in that order. It does not exist. That's a drawing in a textbook. It does not represent what is in the ground. And once I had taken a look at law, process, and evidence, realized that creation is true and evolution is false, and I became a creationist like that. The challenge to you today is this. If you're not already a creationist, will you become one? And if you're not a Christian, will you become one? You don't have to be a Christian to be a creationist, but it's difficult to be a good Christian without being a creationist. Well, nonetheless, we'll turn it over to James. He's going to close us out for tonight. Thank you very much.